KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting Contra Tiempo Activist Dance Theaters, Joy Us, Just Us, a participatory dance theater experience that celebrates joy as resistance, November 22nd and 23rd at UC San Diego's Mandeville Auditorium. Tickets and information, visit artpower.ucsd.edu.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. For today's Arts and Culture Show, a practice that empowers communities to trace their lineage, plus a celebration of noir films and your weekend preview. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and engaged. How memory work helps people learn about themselves and the world around them.
It's the labor of looking back in order to understand your present and have more direction in how to move into your future.
Then we'll talk about the ways noir movies are being celebrated in San Diego this month and your weekend preview. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Have you ever thought about the stories that make you who you are? The practice of memory work empowers communities to trace their lineage, learning about themselves and the world around them. That's the focus of Natalia Ventura's work. She is the resident artist at the San Diego Made Factory, a creative event space serving low-income communities. Ventura sat down with Midday Edition producer Andrew Bracken to talk about what memory work means to her. Here's that conversation.
So before we dig into your personal work, I want to talk about this idea of memory work. Can you define that for us?
Yeah. So the definition that I like to use is it's the labor of looking back in order to understand your present and have more direction in how to move into your future. So it's all about learning the stories of your family, of your community, where you come from, your lineage, and that's a process of sort of grasping onto the remnants that you have or the things that have been passed on to you in this present moment to really understand the context of where you come from, searching for wisdom, searching for the roots of where you come from, basically, to understand the context of where you are now and that wisdom helping you move forward into the future that you want to build.
So what does that look like in practice? What kind of tools do you use to, you know, retrace these roots?
It can look many different ways in practice. We have archivists, historians, people working in museums. For me as an artist, that looks like using passed down family objects to dig into my family's stories. And I use these objects to create sculptures and other multimedia pieces that really tell the story of my internal experiences and my identity in this current context. And I also, it's like a manipulation of materials that have been passed down to me. And with that, I can rebuild what I've been given and use it to create something new and sort of bring to life my visions for the future that I dream of for myself and for my community.
And in this work, you call the act of remembering a radical act. Why is that?
I think that in the culture that we live in, you know, we go to school and we're taught a narrative of our history that often isn't ours and is a narrative that's taught to us that reinforces colonialism and imperialism and white supremacy. And so to dig into your own past in a way that really you're understanding where your ancestors played a role in that, whether they were like on whichever side of history, I think that's a radical act because what you're really doing is searching for truth and creating a different narrative than the one that is dominant, the one that we're taught. And it rewrites history in a way that is rooted in truth. And that's not something that we're really trained to do.
Right.
And so that's why I consider it radical, because we are rewriting history and we're telling a story that is more authentic to us in a way that deconstructs norms and is taking a new direction for the future.
So are there any specific pieces of your own memory work you can share?
Recently, I created a short documentary piece, and it's about my grandmother who lives with my mom and my sisters, and we are all her caretakers. And she's in, like, late-stage dementia. And it's, like, a unique experience to take care of someone who took care of you as a child. And I just feel such a strong connection to sort of the matriarchal lineage on my mom's side of the family, because my great-grandmother passed away the day after I was born. And I wanted to tell this story of the way that we take care of her and just the, like, matriarchal care and love that has been passed down through all the women in my family. And so I documented our process of how we take care of her, and I made sure to use a lot of objects that we have inherited from her side of the family. So we have these, like, big portraits of my great-grandfather and great-grandmother, and I have shots in the documentary that where she's sitting below them and sort of showing this ancestral lineage imagery as being, like, a foundational part of where I am now and the love that I've been taught to give to my family.
Well, and as you described there, I mean, even your grandmother suffering from dementia, I mean, that plays a role into this project, I imagine, just the importance of memory and capturing that across generations, you know?
Absolutely. Because it's often when our elders are at that age where they're forgetting things that we realize there's so much I haven't learned from them. There's so many stories that I never heard. And it's usually in those, like, late moments that we start to think about memory and passing on, you know, our roots. And it can be too late at that point sometimes. So that's why I'm so passionate about this work and, like, empowering myself and others to begin to do memory work in their lives with the elders that are still with us. But there's also, like, a process of tapping into the elders that have passed on and our ancestors. And I really, like, operate in a way that I believe that my ancestors are guiding me through life and are, like, present around me, and I can communicate with them even if it's not, like, a tangible process.
Well, that's really interesting, because I was going to ask you, you know, how do you find this balance between you're trying to document these memories, but at the same time, your role as an artist, like, how do you balance those and how do you approach that?
It starts really with an internal process where I do try to communicate with my ancestors, you know, even just out loud in conversation, through meditation, in those kind of quiet, solitary moments. And sometimes there's just synchronicities that can happen or messages that are received that I feel are sort of this, like, higher knowledge being passed on to me. And when I'm, like, working on a piece, there's often, like, a story that I want to tell, and I move through that. Like, my process is very, like, I feel like I receive the things that I need in order to create the final piece, and I often don't know what those things are, but they become evident throughout the process, and sometimes it's really, like, a message that I can receive, like, in a dream or a conversation that I have with someone where I really feel like something else was speaking through them and things like this.
And I imagine doing this work can be, you know, emotionally draining. How do you work through that? You know, how do you make that, you know, deal with that part of the process?
It is very emotional. And I think that's why it's also considered a radical act. You know, in more indigenous communities or times before colonization or communities that have, you know, not been touched by colonization, emotion is often what rules decision making in a community. And we completely don't operate that way anymore. And so even just the process of tapping into emotion opening up to listening to stories or learning stories that maybe are really difficult to grapple with. There's so much grief sometimes that we suppress when it comes to thinking about our lineage and our ancestors. And so there is so much emotion that can come up through that process. But part of the memory work, I think, is also being in community with others and holding each other through those emotional points. For example, like on my dad's side of the family, they're coming from Cuba, and there's so much political violence that they experienced that was never really addressed. And what happens then is that pain doesn't go away. It just gets suppressed and it gets passed on. And, you know, we talk about generational trauma and things like this. And it's the silence that allows that trauma to pass on. When I was, like, reaching my 20s, I realized that I completely, like, had lost connection with my Cuban identity. And growing up here in San Diego and being a border crosser, I was very in tune with, like, my identity as a Mexican woman and a border crosser. And I pretty much would just tell people that I was Mexican, and I would ignore the fact that I was Cuban, because
it's much easier probably for you.
It was easier. And I, like, after a certain age, like, my grandparents got divorced, and I lost, like, a space to experience my Cuban heritage. And that divorce is also, like, a result of the trauma. And I started to realize, like, that I had felt this disconnect. So then I started asking questions of my father and my grandparents about Cuba. Like, they never told me in my childhood, other than maybe the positive things like the food, the culture, the music. They never told me stories, really, of, like, life in Cuba. And I started to ask questions about why we left and how we left. Like, what did my grandpa have to endure in order to, like, get asylum? And I start finding out all these stories that I never knew about my grandfather being a political prisoner and being in labor camps and all this suffering that he experienced as a result of political violence. And it started to click for me that, like, there's this silence and there's this generational trauma that has caused me to become disconnected from my culture.
I mean, I think what you just shared, though, about, you know, about your grandfather's experience and this generational trauma, a lot of times maybe our elders are hesitant to talk to us about, you know, the past, right? Do you have any, I don't know, suggestions or tips for folks who may want to explore these conversations? Because I think this is, you know, what you kind of tapped into. These are really elemental, important conversations, you know, families could be having more of, right? Mm-hmm.
The first thing I would say is it's going to be uncomfortable, and you just have to accept that. And sometimes you have to ask the questions multiple times to really get to the answer. And it's also about really listening so carefully, because these things are often communicated in metaphor and symbolism. And when I hear the story, when I hear my grandfather tell me a story, like, I look at his body language and I look at the way that he tells the story, the progression, because it can jump from, like, chronologically, like, moments in time, like, the way we remember things, you know?
Right.
So you really have to start to develop this new language of, like, how to understand and piece apart the things that you are told, like, what lies beyond the things that you've been told. And it becomes kind of this language that's very metaphorical, and, like, it becomes poetic because there is just symbolism, and it's not always, like, a flat out, this is what happened to me. So it's inherently, like, a poetic, creative thing. So making art out of it is just so natural to me, because it's actually how I'm able to tell the story more fully in a way that reflects my inner world and my inner consciousness around the story.
I mean, you're right, because it does seem like it's always not necessarily about the exact details of a particular memory, but about the emotions behind it and what that's come to mean for your grandfather in this case, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're hosting a workshop at the San Diego Made Factory tonight. It's free and open to the public. What should people expect to learn about?
Yes. So tonight we'll be having a panel discussion event with myself and three other creative artist memory workers here in San Diego. And we're going to be digging deeper into these questions. I'll be asking them about their own process, their own lineages, how they came to become memory workers, what called to them to do that type of work, and how they're doing it in community and how we can continue to do this work in community. And sort of like just showing people what that process is like on an inner scale as well as like a communal scale, and how you can start to do memory work in your own life.
So in general, why would you encourage people to engage in memory work? What can they gain from it?
I think that it can really strengthen your sense of purpose and direction as to why you're here, and to be able to learn how to make the most with what you've been given in this life and go through a process of inner transformation that can positively affect your tangible life as well and your community. It's how we combat erasure on a larger scale. It's how we can tell our own stories and build communities that are empowered within themselves, within their own story. And I truly think it can be, it's like a really important part of strengthening just an individual's sense of self in a way that can lead to a fuller life.
That was artist Natalia Ventura speaking with Midday Edition producer Andrew Bracken. Coming up, if you don't know what film noir is, here's an easy test.
You can tell it's film noir when the main protagonist gets screwed over in the first 5 minutes and it goes downhill from there.
Hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kara Felt, Curator of Photography at the San Diego Museum of Art. We're pleased to welcome to San Diego Pre-Picte Human, the latest exhibition from the world's leading award for photography and sustainability. The Museum of Photographic Arts at the San Diego Museum of Art is the only U.S. venue on the international tour of Pre-Picte Human. See work by 12 shortlisted photographers, including the award-winner Indian photographer Gauri Gill, in the celebrated exhibition Exploring Human Experiences. Pre-Picte Human is on view now through December 15, 2024 at MOPA at SDMA in Balboa Park. Learn more at mopa.org.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. You might have seen a noir movie or two with its gritty detective characters and seedy settings. Well, lovers of the genre will actually be celebrating it all month. KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando is putting together a Friday night film series called Noirvember Nights. The films will be introduced by Alan K. Rohde of the Film Noir Foundation. She spoke with Rohde about the foundation's work and why noir still resonates with audiences today.
We wouldn't be celebrating film noir if the foundation wasn't out there rescuing films. So give us a little background on the foundation and kind of its mission and the work it does.
Well, the foundation started really around Eddie Muller's kitchen table. It started with the Noir City Festival, and it started with Arthur Lyons' festival. There were a few film noir festivals back in the late 90s, and those were the days where you had people there like Turin Bay and Evelyn Keyes. You still had people that were in these movies in the 1940s who were still around and vital, and it was great to have them as guests. But at any rate, we found that we couldn't get prints, and this was still in the days where everything was 35 millimeter prints, and we couldn't get prints to show at these festivals. They weren't available. So we started the 501C. Eddie began it as the president, And I was one of the original directors or board members. And we initially funded a couple 35 millimeter prints. I believe the first two pictures were Nobody Lives Forever with John Garfield and The Window. You know, we had to wrap our mind around, you know, here we are, a grassroots nonprofit funding Warner Brothers to make prints so we could pay them every time we showed a print that we funded. But it was either that or nothing at that point. And we have funded about 15 different prints. And then we got into the restoration business with Cry Danger, The Prowler, Try and Get Me, other restorations. And we have restored 15 full restorations. And by doing this, we've formed some long-term partnerships with the UCLA Film and Television Archive, who's been our main engine of restoration. And also Flickr Alley, because we've found by restoring films that we can clear the rights to, we can then put them out on Blu-ray. So we've been able to make these films available. Plus, we've been able to produce our own special features and documentaries, of which you, Beth, played a major part in for El Vampiro Negro. So it's been a win-win for film preservation, for keeping, as the motto of the foundation, restoring, rescuing America's noir heritage. Film noir, to my mind, is not a genre, it's a style. It's a look. It's kind of like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. It's a style that was a commingling of hard-boiled writers, immigrant directors, post-World War II neorealism, whatever. And everyone's got, many people have their own take on what is film noir and what isn't, and so on and so forth, and the difference between a crime film and a bad guy. And I always liked the late Arthur Lyon said, you can tell it's film noir when the main protagonist gets screwed over in the first 5 minutes and it goes downhill from there.
What is it about noir, though, that gives it this kind of longevity? It is something that people today watch, and it doesn't feel as dated as some other films. And it really does. I mean, I show noir a lot here in San Diego, and it really connects with people. What do you think it is about it that makes it work so well?
Our lives have changed so much with technology, and culture has changed. One could argue not for the better, depending on one's age or point of view. But as humans, as people, we're pretty much the same. And the thing about noir, it deals with human beings caught in situations and how they react to different situations and the things that drive people. I mean, one indicator of film noir has always been where you have two essentially legitimate people or a protagonist that know that they're doing the wrong thing, but for whatever reasons, they do it anyway. And what are the reasons that these things happen? Greed, lust, larceny, trying to maintain someone's reputation, all of those things. So I think the basic premise of so many of these stories, where the line between good and bad, evil, a code of conduct that may not necessarily be out of the California Penal Code, for instance, but that people can identify with. And I think that's what makes film noir kind of timeless, because it's about human beings in bad situations, either through their own creation or by happenstance, and how they have to deal with that. And I think that really hasn't changed that much. And I think that's what people identify with.
Well, another aspect of noir that I think keeps it contemporary is the female characters. They tend to be a lot stronger and a lot sassier and just kind of operating in a male world better than in a lot of other films. And we are in the middle of this Noirvember Night series that I'm running at Cinema Under the Stars and that you are introducing. And our next film has a very strong female character of Anne Sheridan in Woman on the Run.
Well, where's your husband, Mrs. Johnson?
I don't know.
Did he see the killer?
I don't know.
Should we dance?
Why don't you drop dead?
So tell us a little bit about this film and what you think gives it its special kind of noir quality.
Well, the noir quality in this is that you have a woman who's separated from her husband, but still loves him, kind of, sort of. And she's basically living on her own with a dog. And I should mention that the dog plays a key supporting role, but she's on her own. She came from humble circumstances, her character did. And she's not ready to take any crap from policemen or people, but she's trying to find out where's her husband, because he's involved in a murder.
I'm helping. What do you want me to do?
I want you to answer a few questions.
Go ahead, ask.
Now, where does he generally go when he's not at home?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Has he any relatives in this area?
No.
Who are his friends?
I don't know his friends. The dog is our only mutual friend.
Do you always go to sleep when he walks the dog?
No, sometimes he goes to sleep and I walk the dog.
But it's just a slam-bang great movie, and Anne Sheridan carries the movie. Not just because she's a movie star, but because her character is so authentic and so real.
And one of the other films we're showing, which proves how kind of international noir is El Vampiro Negro, which, again, has very strong female characters. This is a remake of Fritz Lang's M.
El Vampiro Negro, la más reciente y espectacular producción de Argentina Sonofilm, es una obra de máxima tensión, indeleble en las retinas y los corazones, desde la Argentina para el mundo.
Again, this gives us women in very strong roles and with, like, really well-developed, complex characters.
Yeah, and I always thought that the stereotypical description of women in these film noir movies as, quote, the femme fatale, as if she's a female Black Widow spider waiting for the male to mate with her so she can eat him afterwards, you know, is so misplaced, because I think, to your point earlier, these are women in a real male-dominated world. Let's face it, this is the 40s and 50s. And for El Vampiro Negro, the female character in that, she's looked down upon as kind of what they used to call a B-girl or a nightclub girl, which is one step above being a prostitute. And she's a single mom. So she's a single mom left with a kid, and she's doing what she has to do to take care of her kid and to take care of herself. And to my mind, she's really the heroine of this movie. And then you have a police inspector whose wife is in a wheelchair, and he's devoted to his wife, and she seems to be a very saintly, wonderful woman, but he's frustrated because he cannot have a full, relationship with his wife, to put it delicately. And so he has a sense of duty, but he also has those human instincts that I talked about earlier also driving him. And then you have the character that is playing the, what I would call the Peter Lorre part. And this is someone else who is a tormented soul because he's compelled to do what he does, but he loathes himself and he loathes that he's being compelled to do this. And so what you have is a great film, the third version, the unknown in America, third version of M, that is absolutely a compelling and terrific film.
Well, another interesting thing that has come out more recently about this film for me was I worked on this Stripper Energy podcast about our Les Girls Theater and Cotta Pierce Morgan. And in El Vampiro Negro, she is a cabaret singer and dancer. And there are moments when the cops come to interview her, and the way those scenes play out feel very similar to what Cotta discussed about, like, these nude interrogations that the cops would, you know, do, and this power dynamic that was going on. And in El Vampiro Negro, That scene is one of the best in it, where she gets interrogated and she tries to kind of like flip the script on the cop and try to make him feel embarrassed for, you know, coming and interviewing her in her dressing room.
Yeah, she doesn't, even though she's terrified and intimidated, she doesn't let him run her over, so to speak. And by the way, your documentary series on lay girls not only was terrific, and showed a time in San Diego of real abuse by certain members of law enforcement and the vice squad of the San Diego Police Department. It was very insightful, and I think your comparison between that particular scene in El Vampiro Negro and what the cabaret dancers at Lay Girls back in the early and mid 70s were subjected to, there's a lot of parallels there.
The last film in the series that we're doing is rather unique because repeat performance has kind of, I don't know if I'd call it a supernatural element, but it does have a quality that you don't often find in a classic film noir.
That's true. In fact, repeat performance has been compared to a extended episode either of Twilight Zone or Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
People do live things over. Haven't you ever entered a strange room, William, and felt that you'd been there before? You knew it was impossible, yet everything in the room looked familiar. Hasn't that ever happened to you, William? William? William, where are you?
William won't answer. William is gone. He was there just a moment ago. But in that moment, time stopped for Sheila. Time ran backwards. She made a wish. A tragic one at a magic time. When the new year was beginning. And now that wish is coming true. She's going to live the old year all over again.
And it's basically most of the film is a flashback from one year to another. I don't think we're giving anything away. But this was another film that we restored, and we funded the restoration by UCLA in conjunction with David Packer's Humanities Institute. We really needed a new print of this film. And in addition to Joan Leslie, you have Lewis Hayward and you have Richard Basehart in his film debut. And it's really a compelling film. It's the best. It's really a holiday film for film noir. It's a good film noir to show around Christmas. And this was the initial production of Eagle Lion Films, which on the Blu-ray disc for repeat performance, there's a documentary about the history of Eagle Lion. And this was they were going to try to make major films. And this was their first effort. What Eagle Lion was forced to do was to sign, you know, Lewis Hayward and Joan Leslie were terrific actors and they were movie stars, but they were second tier stars. They were not, you know, Ava Gardner and Clark Gable and so on and so forth, and Ida Lupino and stars like that. But it's a very, very entertaining, interesting film. And I think your audience is really going to appreciate it.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for helping us make a more festive Noirvember here in San Diego with all these films. And thanks for all your work with the Noir Foundation.
Well, Beth, I thank you for all your work with San Diego Film Geeks and KPBS and all the support you've given the Film Noir Foundation and my endeavors over the years. And this is like akin to Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart walking off the soundstage arm in arm at the end of Casablanca. So thank you very much for having me.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Well,
That was Alan K. Rohde of the Film Noir Foundation speaking with KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando. November Nights runs through the next three Fridays at 8 p.m. at Cinema Under the Stars in Mission Hills. Still to come, we'll tell you all about the cultural events and art exhibits you can find this weekend, including an adorable play about trash pandas.
It's about a group of three raccoons who are kind of mischievous, and they're tasked with taking care of a campsite. And so they start to play around and create things out of the objects in the trash.
KPBS Midday Edition returns after the break.
Hi, I'm Bill Hoehn.
And I'm Ted Hoehn.
Over the past 50 years, our family has brought many world-class dealerships to Carlsbad, including Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, Audi, Honda, Acura, Jaguar, and Land Rover.
That's right. This year we're celebrating 50 years in Carlsbad.
So on behalf of the entire Hoehn family, we want to thank San Diego. Throughout the years, we've taken tremendous pride in meeting and even exceeding our customers' automotive needs.
We value the relationships with our clients and look forward to serving you for years to come. We invite you to visit one of the Hoehn Carlsbad dealerships or hoehnmotors.com.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. This weekend in the arts, we have a wide range of ways to get your culture fix, even including an option for preschoolers. Joining me with all the details is KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, welcome.
Hey, Jade. Thanks for having me.
As always, it's a pleasure. So first up, we have two very different plays, and a single cast is actually tackling them both in Moxie Theater's Our Dear Dead, Little Women.
Right. It sounds like it might be one of those zombie versions, like of classic literature, but it's actually not. It's two otherwise faithful productions of two plays. One of them is the Broadway musical version of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, and the other is Alexis Scheer's Our Dear Dead Drug Lord, which is a comedy thriller, kind of a ghost story about a group of high school girls. And the unique thing here is that Moxie's producing these in rep. So a single cast is taking on both productions, alternating nights on the same stage. So not only does the cast have to switch gears each night and play totally different roles, but the stagehands and the tech team, they also have to swap out the whole set. And you can get two show passes to get the full experience. And it kind of would be nice to follow this group of four actors taking on each of the leads of each play. Like, I can imagine that someone's performance is one of the Little Women would influence how I see them doing this character in Our Dear Dead Drug Lord. So that's totally fascinating to me. And it'll be on stage at Moxie, which is in Rolando, until December 8th.
All right. Well, next we have some classical music from the San Diego Symphony. What are they performing this weekend?
So they're doing Dvorak's Ninth Symphony from the New World. It's often just called the New World Symphony. And this is such an impressive piece of music and was actually composed while he was living in the United States. And it's inspired by African American spirituals. And they're also playing a piece of music by a contemporary composer, Thomas Addis. It's a violin concerto called Concentric Paths. And this is a really mesmerizing piece of music, a lot of artistry, showing off what the violin can do. And they'll do a Foxtrot-inspired piece by American composer John Adams. This is all this weekend at Jacobs Music Center, Saturday night and Sunday afternoon.
All right. Well, next up, some literature. There's a group reading at the Book Catapult on Saturday night. What can you tell us?
Yeah, this is the Small Press Night. It's a reading series that's been going on. This is their 7th installment. And I love this event because it's kind of a celebration of small presses and the sort of inventive work that doesn't necessarily always get published by the big 5 publishing houses. They're kind of following that trend cycle of what sells. And so this is really nice to see the creative things that writers can come up with. And their readers this weekend are Jack Gems, who is the author of the book Empty Theater, and one of my favorite literary horror reads called The Grip of It. And she's also a professor of literature at UC San Diego. Also reading is D.T. Robbins, who wrote Birds Aren't Real, Lexi Kent Monning, author of The Burden of Joy, and then Manuel Paul Lopez, who is a poet and author of Nerve Curriculum, among other collections. He's also edited a bunch of anthologies from CityWorks Press and teaches at San Diego City College. So this is a free event. It's a really great chance to have a bunch of good writers read a short excerpt or a standalone story or some poems. It's Saturday night at 7 at the Book Catapult in South Park.
All right. Sounds like a lot of fun. Okay, this next one sounds fun as well. The Vitamin String Quartet is known as the crossover ensemble that arranged some of the pop songs for the Netflix show Bridgerton, and they're coming to town.
Right. So Vitamin String Quartet, or VSQ as they're sometimes known, they'll perform at Epstein Family Amphitheater at UC San Diego on Friday night. And they'll do arrangements of a bunch of new pop music, including Taylor Swift, BTS, Billie Eilish, and more, as well as their Bridgerton hits. This is their arrangement of Ariana Grande's Thank You, Next, that was featured in the show.
Very classy, very classy. Well, City Ballet is wrapping up their 2-week run of Dracula this Saturday in Escondido. Tell us about this ballet.
Yeah, this is by the company choreographer Jeff Gonzalez. It's his adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula into a ballet using music by Franz Liszt. And there's a twist. It portrays Dracula as a woman, the Countess Dracula, and follows the women that she preys upon. And to round out the evening, they're also going to perform some Balanchine work and choreography by Annabelle Lopez Ochoa. This is 8 o'clock Saturday night at California Center for the Arts, Escondido.
And one more visual art pick. Art Produce in North Park is having a midday reception this weekend.
Right. This is partly to celebrate the closing reception for Marianela De La Hoz, whose exhibit Polvo de Luz, or Stardust, has been on view in the main gallery. And she paints like contemporary images, kind of surrealist, really intricate stuff, but she uses ancient methods like egg tempera. And also that day is an open studio for Michelle Montjoy. She is in doing her artist residency in the cooler room there, and she'll be showing off some of what she's been working on, like textile installation stuff. And this is all in the middle of the day. You don't have to stay up late. It's 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday, and it's free. And both artists will be there to say hello.
That's my kind of timing there. In Oceanside, the annual Valley Arts Festival takes place on Saturday. What do you know about that event?
This is a celebration of the indigenous First Peoples of the Oceanside area, the San Luis Rey Band of Mission Indians. And this is the 4th year that they've done this event. It's free. It's family friendly. They have live music, storytelling, drumming, and dancing. And this year they're introducing some dancing demonstrations that you can participate in. There's a community mural that you can add to. And then a bunch of activities like rock painting. There's a model of a traditional home structure, a Native American artist gift market, and plenty more. And it's all at Heritage Park in Oceanside from 11 to 4 on Saturday.
And there's something for the kids that sounds a little silly, a play called Trash Pandemonium.
This is a collaboration between San Diego Junior Theater and then local theater company Blind Spot Collective. Blind Spot does a lot of like boundary pushing, emerging theater works. They have collaborated on the Washed Ashore project. That was when that giant puppet, Little Amal, came to San Diego. They've done Without Walls productions as well. And this is a project, though, that's specifically geared towards little kids, like preschool through second grade. And of course, all ages are welcome. The runtime is only 35 minutes, again, for that little kid age attention span. And it's about a group of three raccoons who are kind of mischievous, and they're tasked with taking care of a campsite. And so they start to play around and create things out of the objects and the trash that's left behind. So it touches on themes of creativity and also taking care of the planet. And it's on stage this weekend at Casa del Prado Theater in Balboa Park. There's three morning shows, Saturday at 11:30, and then Sunday morning at 10 and 11:30.
Before we go, let's take a look at our live music choices this weekend. What shows are on your radar?
Okay, so tonight at Whistle Stop Bar, Desdemonas, they're a garage rock and punk band out of Washington, D.C., and they just put out a new single. The last music that they'd released was in 2021. It was their full-length Cure for Love, which was a really great album. It was in your face and powerful, and this is their new single. It's called Duke Ellington Bridge. And they're playing Whistle Stop tonight with local punk band Witness. And on Sunday, Northern Californian Bazzi Vibe, their neo-soul R&B act, who's Filipino, Native American, will be playing at Soda Bar with locals Devlov and Rowan Messina. And Bazzi Vibe just put out a new single called Mercy Me last week.
Mercy, 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 mercy. Mercy, mercy, baby, mercy me, hey, them pants gon' be the dead.
All right, sounds like a show, and you can find details on these and sign up for Julia's weekly arts newsletter at kpbs.org/arts. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thanks.
Thank you, Jade.
So cold on me.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ladan Akbarnia, curator of South Asian and Islamic art at the San Diego Museum of Art, where we are showcasing a new exhibition exploring Islamic art, science, and culture through the lens of wonder. Wonders of Creation, Art, Science, and Innovation in the Islamic World presents more than 200 works spanning 13 centuries across two galleries, inviting visitors to discover marvels of the universe through intersections of art and science and humanities, customs, and crafts. See medieval tools and treasures, ornate jewelry, lavishly illustrated manuscripts, and large-scale works of contemporary art. Get tickets at sdmart.org.